This is day four of this January 2014 Rohatsu 7-day Sesshin. We'll return to our text, the teachings of 20th century Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim, reading from The Way of Korean Zen, and this was edited by Stephen Batchelor. We'll take up a new chapter. This is called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. First lecture. I venture to ask the assembly, all of you, endowed with a pure, undefiled, original nature, have you completely awakened to it or not? If by chance you have penetrated the profound meaning of the patriarchs, then say something. Notice he's on safe ground here when he says, have you completely awakened to it or not? He would probably acknowledge that he himself hadn't. According to Buddhist teaching, the only person who has attained supreme perfect enlightenment is Shakyamuni. There's a wonderful exhortation from a Chinese master who said, the unenlightened must strive as if mourning father and mother. The enlightened, too, must strive as if mourning father and mother. There's no beginning to practice or end to enlightenment. The masters knew this. Kusan, we read in this little biographical account how after one awakening experience and then yet another one, he still felt he could go further and went to great lengths to reach that. This is the one of the many paradoxes of Zen is that every one of us, without exception, can still go further. There is when I was at a Rinzai temple in Japan, on the there's a little wooden stand in the zendo that the inking bell rests on, and there was a character, or a couple characters on that stand, and Japanese characters, Chinese characters, and I asked, what does it mean? And I was told it meant, not yet. Well, that's half the paradox. The other half is we've always been there. We have nowhere we need to go. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. This very body, the body of Buddha. In our true nature, we have all are equally endowed with this bright, luminous, original nature. How could we possibly attain what we already have? He continues, although many rivers converge in the sea, in the end their taste is one and the flow of their waters comes to an end. Likewise, defilements and false thinking endlessly flow from the conditioned mind. Due to this, we suffer beneath the wheel of birth and death. But when the mind from which defilements and false thinking flow is completely cut off, high and low disappear. common and accomplished beings vanish. Originally, all is equal. Therefore, the pure original face cannot be assailed. And then it says that he strikes his staff. The pure original nature that is able to hear this sound and see the staff cannot be assailed. It does not undergo the suffering of birth and death. It is not stained by defilements. That's Mu. What is it? All the affairs of the world are just like dreams. With a single stroke of a knife, completely sever all concerns. Only search for awakening. Not only must you discard all worldly fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning, and cleverness, but the Buddhas as well. You must finish with it all. The Buddhas as well. Any notion about our Buddha nature. Get rid of it. Let it go. All the more so, concerns about fame, wealth, glory, comfort. No doubt there are people who would want to have a sesshin like this warmer. It's toasty compared to the conditions in Japan, for sure. The trouble with having everything just the way we like it is then we get attached to that. It's not a service. It's not a kindness. To always be working to keep everyone pleased. Because it's never enough. There's always going to be something more we want or something we want to have changed to perfectly match our preferences. One of the advantages of keeping it cool as we do is that it's easier to stay alert, less susceptible to drowsy states, torpid states. Learning, this is another one in that series, discard all worldly fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning. That's a hard one for some people. A lot of people it's not, but some people, because of their values, their conditioning, they just want to acquire knowledge, be able to be in a position to speak with authority about this and that. And it's not going to get you any closer to awakening. Cleverness. Wit. An ancient master once said, "The bright light of the mind has never darkened. From ages past to the present, it has been the brilliant way," or the Tao. "When entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge." Intellectual, it can be a misleading word. There aren't many that are better than that, but because intellectual sounds, it can be understood as wanting to just, you know, discuss subtle concepts and philosophy and all. But I think it really means discard discriminating knowledge, discard all trafficking in thought when entering this door. Yeah, that's the end of the quote of this ancient master. Then he said, "This bright spiritual light, which is able to hear this sound and see this staff, has not darkened even once. Not once has it become a sentient being." Sentient being is just the conventional way of referring to the unenlightened, an unenlightened being. Not once has it become a sentient being. Not once has it become a Buddha. Why not? Now, why has it not become an unenlightened being or a Buddha? Because the realm of becoming is something else than this essential nature of ours. Again, how can we become what we have always been? For this reason, it is the way that is eternally radiant. Therefore, when entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. After practicing for a while, you may come to think that you know something. Then you start conceptualizing. This approach is wrong. Therefore, avoid speculative thinking. Every practice in Zen, whether it's a breath practice or a koan practice, is all meant to deliver us from our attachment to our acquired knowledge, our thoughts and opinions and concepts and notions. That's what they all have in common. We don't even have to deliberately make a project of discarding anything. That's the beauty of this practice. We just have to lose ourselves in whatever practice we're working on, and the discarding happens. The thoughts subside. Ultimately, there's nothing we need to do. It's about non-doing, what the Japanese called wu wei, non-doing. It's better expressed as allowing ourselves to merge with mu, in the case of mu, or with the breath. Because we're basically not separate from, how can we be separate from the breath? In the same way, we can't be separate from mu. It's just another word for our true nature. Or it, let's call it it. Mu, it. I, who am I, what is it, what is mu? It's not apart from us. You must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. Sincerity. I understand sincerity in Zen to mean single-mindedness, that is, without a divided mind. When we're sincere, there's something whole about us. We're not split. There isn't part of us holding back or part of us observing. We're wholly there. Wholly into what we're doing when we're sincere. When we're saying something to someone and we're sincere, it's pure. It's whole. It's not divided. To practice simply because others are doing so is just imitation. I've never seen that as a problem here. Just because others are doing so. Yeah. Adopt the latest fad. Do zazen. Don't be a late adopter. You will never achieve anything in that way. You must truly awake. Let me stop. In these monasteries, however, one would become a monk, according to everything I've read, often without any genuine spiritual motivation. It became a kind of a harbor have a nice, get your 3 square meals a day, or in the case of Zen monks, 2 square meals a day. At times of turmoil, civil unrest and political turmoil, and these were in China, there were centuries of terrible violence and unrest, and parents would take their children to the monasteries, or as orphans the children would come to the monasteries, and they may have no real spiritual interest. So maybe some of that was true even last century, during the time of Kusan Sunim, where people signed up and went to the monasteries and, I don't know, got some benefits other than spiritual benefits. You must truly awaken in order to be freed from the suffering of birth and death. Knowledge and conceptualization are not appropriate. When you investigate the koan and intend to awaken to your great original nature, you must be like a hen hatching eggs. Remember, Kusan was raised on a farm. Think about how much effort the hen must exert in order to successfully hatch eggs. From dawn to dusk, she constantly pecks and searches for food. Imagine how hungry she gets while sitting on the eggs all day long. If she frequently leaves to eat or drink, only half of them will hatch properly. The rest will rot. While the hen is hatching her eggs, she does not just sit quietly. She moves the eggs around with her feet in order to evenly distribute the heat. Only in this way will the chicks hatch successfully. It is the same for somebody practicing meditation. Whether you are investigating what is this, mu, or the cypress in the courtyard, the practice will not mature if you just hold the koan motionless. If you just watch it repeating, what is this, what is this, then you would be like a hen trying to hatch her eggs without moving them. This would be foolish. You cannot awaken in this manner. You must be like the hen who moves her eggs around. This is a question that comes up pretty often when people say, when I try to question, it seems forced and contrived, and should I keep trying? And I've come to advise people that if that's how it feels, if it feels artificial, then just become one with the koan. Just become one with the koan. Well, in the case of an interrogative koan, like, what is this? Who am I? Well, that pretty much requires that you make it a question. With mu, you can just concentrate single-mindedly on the word mu, and if you do it long enough, it will become puzzling. It'll become, the questioning will rise up from that concentration. Nonetheless, even without questioning as such, one should be willing and ready to turn the soil now and then, take a look at it in different ways, try something creative. I can't spell it out. Just if you're determined enough, you will find a different approach, or a second approach, a third approach. There are different ways of becoming one with a koan, and you can find them. How do you do it? If you feel that things are static, you're just not, there's no movement, then okay, try something different with the koan. That's how I would interpret this, like turning the eggs when you're not questioning the koan. And that kind of turning of the eggs can actually lead to genuine questioning. Skipping some paragraphs here that aren't suitable. And then he says, you must also be like a cat trying to catch a mouse. Observe the look of a cat that is trying to catch a mouse at the foot of a stone wall. While slinking along at the base of the wall, it keeps its eyes firmly fixed on the hole where the mouse entered. At a place far away from the hole, it then sits silently in hiding. Its eyes continue to stare piercingly at the hole while waiting for the mouse to come out. At such a time, even if a person, a chicken or a dog, goes near the cat, it takes no notice of their passing and continues to watch the mouse hole. If the mouse appears for even an instant, like a flash of lightning, it leaps and grabs it. If even a cat proceeds so mindfully when trying to catch a mouse, how much more so should a person pursue awakening when practicing meditation? Furthermore, you must practice with a feeling of urgency, as though you were trying to extinguish a fire burning on your head. That's a classic Zen analogy for a kind of sense of urgency that works best in practicing. In such a situation, would you stop to ponder, is this heat due to fire, or is it really burning or not? Is there anybody present here who would experiment and let the fire burn for a while to see how well it burns? Under such circumstances, without thinking, you would immediately brush your hand over your head in order to get rid of the fire. You should cultivate meditation with the same sense of urgency. To live long would be to live for 100 years. A short life is over in the time it takes to inhale and exhale a single breath. 100 years of life depends upon a single breath, for life stops when respiration ceases. Can you afford to wait for 100 years when you do not know how soon death will come? You may die after having eaten a good breakfast in the morning. You may die in the afternoon after a good lunch. Some die during sleep. You may die in the midst of going here and there. No one can determine the time of death. Therefore, you must awaken before you die. Well, it seems to be human nature that we assume that we're going to go on living indefinitely. This assumption is all but universal, at least till we get older and older, then it changes. Young people are at the greatest disadvantage with this because it's just so hard to buy your mortality when you're young. It's really an exceptional young person then who practices with great ardor, because underneath that there must be the awareness of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. And there's no, I can't imagine a better fuel for practice than the keen awareness of our inevitable death and the uncertainty of the time of it. Zen Master Dogen, those who would practice the Dharma must deeply, deeply feel the passing nature of things and have faith in karma. Dogen would have been shown the evidence of the transiency of life with his own losses. He lost both parents, one at, I think, the age of 3, and then the other at the age of 10, something like that. And I'm going back to Milarepa, the great Tibetan Buddhist master from the 13th century, I think, something like that. You've all heard this, but I don't know. I myself can't hear it often enough. Affairs and business will drag on forever, so lay them down and practice now the Dharma. If you think tomorrow is the time to practice, suddenly you find that life has slipped away. Who can tell when death will come? It's why it's such a privilege working with people in Sesshin, because I got to assume that everyone who comes to Sesshin, who subjects themselves to this kind of effort and pain, has got to have a sense of this impermanence, this uncertainty of the time of death. And he says, look at the sea. Not only when there is wind do waves arise. Even when the sea is calm, waves are rising and falling thousands of times. And this paragraph stands on its own, this very short paragraph. I think the way I would take this is that he's really talking about the waves of cause and effect, of karma. That we can't become complacent when things are stable and peaceful in our lives and everything is just fine. Because even when the sea is calm, waves are rising and falling thousands of times. We are continuously stitching together our karma. I think he's implicitly saying, use the time that you have. A defiled person will call this world a sea of suffering. An awakened one will call it a Buddha world. At that time, the 10,000 things will be transformed into the 10,000 subtle functions. For an enlightened person, it is simply all illuminated. For a defiled person, it is simply all defiled. All is arising from your own mind. The Buddha world arises from your own mind. its transformation into the sea of suffering likewise arises from your own mind. This is the premise of meditation, that the mind determines everything, almost everything. Circumstances play a role, but when all is said and done, it's what we make of them. It's the mind. It's our perspective. And then he ends, assembly, reflect on this. I trust that your practice will progress during this winter retreat. Second lecture. Since we have entered this meditation retreat, 2 weeks have gone by. Now only 75 days remain. That's the most predictable laugh line of every time I've read it. See, there's a lot of anxiety behind laughter. And then I always feel obliged at this point to say that that these 90-day retreats that you read about in China and Korea, I haven't heard of them much, at least not by those names. I haven't heard of them in Japan, but these 90-day retreats are nothing like a 7-day sesshin in terms of the rigor and the schedule and everything. At least this is what I was told when I was on one of my pilgrimages in Japan. I happened to find myself sharing an apartment for a night with a monk who had been at Kusan Sunim's center, Songguangsa. And he had been to both Songguangsa and Bukokuji, where I had gone to sesshin. And without my even raising it, he said, "Oh, but these 90-day retreats," he says, there's a lot of sleeping. A lot of people are sleeping in the Zendo. And they don't use the stick there. But back to Kusan's lecture, Teisho. The sufferings of transmigrating within the ocean of birth and death, as well as the happiness of the sublime Dharma Dhatu appearing brilliantly clear before your eyes, do not come from outside. They are also not given to us by anyone else. You do not have to endure sufferings because someone else gave them to you. Neither does somebody else grant you happiness. They are created and experienced by yourself alone. You have to endure sufferings because you created them yourself. Likewise, you experience happiness because you have created it yourself. Well, this is the kind of the orthodox, simple teaching of the law of causation, that there are no accidents. That even if not in this lifetime, we've done nothing in this lifetime to create suffering for ourselves, well, there were those other 100 trillion lifetimes. We may have not been perfect Buddhas. This is not unknown in the West, this understanding of how we are the architects of our own fate. Matthew Arnold, back in the 19th century, said, "We do not what we ought. What we ought not, we do. And lean upon the thought that chance will bring us through. But our own acts, for good or ill, are mightier powers." Someone else said, what people ask for when they pray to God is that 2 and 2 not make 4. during the 24 hours of the day in all of the four positions. Four positions is, again, a kind of a conventional Buddhist way of referring to whatever you're doing. And the four positions are standing, sitting, walking, and lying down. In all of the four positions, when you are coming, the koan should be coming. And when you are going, the koan should also be going. You should investigate earnestly, carefully, and in detail. Earnestly, carefully, and in detail. The word that came to me when I figured out this is how to work on Mu was meticulously, to get in there with complete attention and meticulously look, what is it? Look directly. Keep looking. Look more deeply. He continues, I always carefully observe meditators when they are walking here and there. How many hold the koan firmly? Usually when they are coming and going or eating, they completely forget about the koan and just act blindly according to circumstances. With such practice, it is hard to say when such people will ever awaken. You must pay a great deal of attention to this point. You should take great awakening as your aim and model and never let the mind be at ease. If you act without caring to raise the koan, mind and body will surely be at ease, but this is just like water flowing away. So there is the bare fact that when you're really working seriously with a koan, when you're in the grip of the koan, it's not going to be pleasant. It's sort of the nature of a koan that it sets up a tension. It sets up a state of unrest. Because until you resolve it, there it is, and that's going to leave you feeling not at rest. Again, he said, but this about not raising the koan, just sort of forgetting the koan, mind and body will surely be at ease, but this is just like water flowing away. Indeed, the lives of sentient beings flow away like this. Now, having taken up the practice of 10,000 actions, that's in quotation marks, I'm not sure what it alludes to. Well, it alludes to maintaining practice through everything you do. Now, having taken up the practice of 10,000 actions, you should endure what is difficult to endure and do what is difficult to do. This is known as austerity, for the very reason that it involves undergoing what is difficult. The Buddhas and the patriarchs did not realize Buddhahood easily. They realized it through great effort and much hardship. They exerted themselves with such great effort because the sufferings of birth and death are so terrifying. Therefore, even though you want to sleep more, you should sleep less. Even though you want to eat more, you should eat less. Even though you want to talk a lot, you should try to talk less. by the way, again, with regard to these 90-day retreats, they don't maintain complete silence. He's just asking, urging the monks to talk less. Even though you want to see many things, you should see less. Your body will definitely feel restrained by acting in such a way. This is indeed a practice of austerity. However, none of the Buddhas and the patriarchs would have awakened had they not trained themselves in this manner. Of these examples of self-restraint, sleeping less, eating less, I would think that talking less would be the easiest. Being bound by circumstances originates from the mind's own bondage. Likewise, liberation from the suffering of birth and death ensues from the mind's being liberated from them. This is the Dharma of one mind. Everything there is proceeds from this one mind. Access to the doors of both liberation and bondage lies in your own hands. It is not dependent upon anyone else. It is not dependent upon the Buddhas, nor the patriarchs, nor the spiritual advisors. It is solely in your own hands. And then there is a verse here. I don't know if it's his, or I suppose it's not. Doesn't have quotation marks. All the mountains, all the rivers, such a beautiful landscape. During endless eons, in each life, this world has appeared. No amount of praise could be enough. It is not the product of anyone's strength. Every single aspect of it arises from your own mind. In a very real sense, when we wake up in the morning, we create the world. When we fall into sleep, the world disappears. Last autumn, the maple trees were brilliant red, the chrysanthemums fragrant, the mountains and rivers, a magnificent sight. When we see all these beautiful things, we all know how to be happy. During endless eons in every life, we have been praising such things. It is not only this one time that we have praised them. When the moon is bright and the wind blows, some say that the moon is shining brightly and a refreshing wind is blowing. However, others say that the moon looks bleak and the wind is dreary. In reality, do you think that the moon is shining brightly to some and bleakly to others? This is not the case. These are circumstantial impressions arising from their own minds. In brief, to awaken to the mind should be your fundamental goal. Our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.